You're listening to Quality Cast North. I'm Cher Chewy.
And I'm Deanna Janskin.
The Quality Improvement Initiative, or PQI, is a province-wide program with teams very similar to our own in Northern Health, operating in each of the other provincial health authorities and all sharing the same goal, which is empowering their physicians to learn and develop quality improvement skills so they can apply them in their own practice settings. Today, in the first of a series of special episodes, we're leaving the snowy and icy north and heading south to showcase some of the excellent quality improvement work being done by physicians in the Vancouver and Fraser Valley area. In the first of our Vancouver sessions, we're talking today about what happens after an emergency department visit, a time when patients, particularly those without a family doctor, can be lost to follow-up and risk falling through the cracks in their continuity of care. Also in today's episode, we'll be discussing the topic of QI publishing, including the why and how of publishing our QI work. And to talk about both of these, we have two guests today, emergency department physician, Dr. Diala El-Zamar, and the provincial PQI physician champion for publishing, Dr. Raj Johal. Hello to both of you, and thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So before we get started on learning more about your project work, we wanted to get to know you a little bit more. So Diala, where did you grow up and what did you enjoy doing as a kid?
So I grew up in Lebanon up until the age of 9. And my family moved to Canada during the Civil War. So we were immigrants. I settled with my family in Surrey, BC. And so we lived there for most of my childhood in Canada. As a child, I remember being more than of a nerd than anything else, to be honest. So I loved reading. I read a lot of French novels and a lot of science books, preparing for science fairs, embarrassed to say. And I did enjoy playing sports. Lacrosse was my favorite, probably because it was the only sport I actually was good at. But I definitely enjoyed playing lacrosse.
That's very interesting. And, you know, building on from that, from your experiences in childhood, what did your parents do and how did that shape your ultimate journey into becoming a physician?
So in Lebanon, my dad owned his own body shop and he had to change it up a bit when we came to Canada. So he worked also in a body shop, but then he repaired big semi trucks, which is where he could get work really within his field. Growing up, my mom was mostly a stay-at-home mom with my sister and my brother and I. And sometimes she did have to do some work and see if she worked in a bakery once in a while to support our family when necessary. So my parents honestly really instilled the values of hard work and devotion, I think, in my siblings and I. So it was very important for them to be able to support us in a way that we would have everything we ever wanted or needed. And so I feel that strong work ethic and the commitment towards our family and towards just our employers and being a part of a workforce was really important for them to instill in us. And I think that's what encouraged me to go into medicine, because I knew it was a field where I could work hard and it would be a rewarding field. And I also felt that my parents always encouraged me to do what I love and to try and help people in the process. And I feel like medicine kind of draws people like who want to help other people. And I find that in the work I do right now, despite all the challenges, especially with COVID, the values my parents instilled in me make it so that I can do what I love while helping others as well.
That's great. Yeah, I'm sure they must be very proud of you as well.
Yeah, I think they are.
And how about you, Raj? Where did you grow up and what did you enjoy doing in your childhood?
Like Diala, I grew up in Surrey. I was actually born and raised in Surrey. And just on that, I've known Diala for a while now, and I didn't know this about her. This is nice to get to know someone who I've known for a long time in more detail. But I was born at Surrey Memorial Hospital, just in the Fraser Valley. And I grew up in a household where sports was a common thing. I'm the eldest of my siblings and got involved in sports very early. So that was probably as far as what I enjoyed doing as a kid was certainly being outside any chance I could to either play basketball, played on a hockey team, we played soccer. Sports is definitely what I enjoyed the most as a kid.
Well, that's great. And again, how about your family and what did they do? And did that influence you into your journey into medicine?
Yeah, I think so. My parents immigrated to Canada and then sort of developed on their respective fields here. My mom was an ICU nurse, and my dad is was a researcher. He did his PhD in physical organic chemistry, actually at UBC, and came here to Canada on a grant, and ended up staying here. And I think just especially I think a combination of my dad's work ethic, a very, very hard worker, and was always wanted to push to be in the top of his field, work ethic there. And then my mom's sort of being in the healthcare field and healthcare industry is sort of, I guess the combination of the two sort of pushed me towards medicine in a way. And yeah, never looked back since.
Well, that's very interesting. I just wanted to interject too, because you both are from, I mean, not necessarily originally, but spend a lot of time in your childhood in Surrey. And just to give our listeners who may not know the geography, Shira and I are in Prince George, which is about 8 hours north drive of Surrey. And we did just mention that we're leaving the snow and the ice, but I understand it's like unseasonably snowy and you have true winter down there right now.
Definitely. I don't think I've seen so many car accidents on the road before, but yeah, we got hit pretty hard this week.
A lot of chaotic car stuff on the news. So anyway, that's very interesting. We'll move on. And Dr. Chewy is going to ask some questions about your projects.
Sure. Yeah. Well, talking about accidents and emergencies, as it were, let's move on and talk about your quality improvement work, Diala. And before we dive right into the project itself, I wonder whether you can tell us a little bit about the community and the hospital and the departmental team that you work with.
Yes, of course. So I work in Chilliwack General Hospital in the emergency department. Chilliwack is about an hour and a half from Vancouver. And so it's a mid-sized community hospital that caters to just about over 113,000 people. And it's a rapidly growing community. So with the COVID pandemic, more people have moved out east towards Chilliwack. And it runs like a rural hospital, really. Despite being a larger population, we still don't have a hospitalist system. So we actually run the hospital with family physicians who still see their own patients in hospital if they have privileges and run their own clinics. So it's a great community hospital to work in that context. And just more and more as the population is growing here, we're realizing how poor access we're getting to patients because many of them don't have family physicians and do seek some of their primary care through the emergency department. And so that allows us to be able to help those patients if we need to, but we do have restricted resources because of the volume of patients we're seeing.
The next question, which I think you're beginning to hint at, is how did you come to realize that there was a need for improvement in the specific area of your project, which was to become your focus?
So at the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic, our ER volumes in the Fraser Health region were reduced to about 50%. The patients were so apprehensive and fearful of seeking healthcare because they didn't want to get COVID from hospital settings. And so patients presented to the ER, either when they did present, they would just want to leave right away. So we would draw blood, maybe do imaging studies, and then they're like, I'm leaving. I don't want to wait for the results. Or if they presented and needed to be admitted, they refuse admission. They're like, I'd rather just go home, even though I might need surgery, or I just had a stroke, or something more serious. And so we were seeing delayed presentations of heart attacks and bad infections and appendicitis in patients. And that kind of struck for us, the need to help, to create something to help those patients.
So tell us about the project itself and what were you trying to achieve and how did you go about it?
The project came about just from some discussions in terms of, okay, so we now have this concept of virtual healthcare that we're exploring. They were exploring that in primary care. And is there any role for that in following up on these patients that were potentially deteriorating at home without any follow-up? And so the idea would be that physicians, ER physicians, would identify patients at risk of deterioration or that needed follow-up on these lab results or imaging results. And so for 2 hours each day, an ER physician would be assigned to call these patients and provide the necessary follow-up. Our process of how we approached this, we initially discussed it with our own physician group in the ER to see if there was a desire and interest for people to run this service. And then we moved on to talk to ER leadership as well as hospital leadership to ensure that we were still working within the mandate of Fraser Health and the expectations within our departments and that we had the manpower for it. And finally, we also involved the Chilliwack Division of Family Practice. So as I mentioned, the family physician group is very important in running the hospital, and we want to collaborate with them to make sure that we're providing the service to patients who need it, and that patients who do have a family physician primarily follow up with their own family physicians, which is important for continuity of care. So we designed the process with that in mind, so that we were catering to unattached patients or patients who could not access their own family physicians or nurse practitioners in a timely manner.
That's great. So that's actually quite a novel new service in many ways there. You must have come across some challenges or difficulties during the implementation. For example, how did your ED physicians take to the concept of a new virtual clinic pilot following up patients which they may not have seen necessarily the day before? How did you overcome these challenges?
Yeah, it was a bit of a different way for us to practice. And so there were a couple of challenges that came about. We actually began with a pilot project for 2 months to make sure that everybody involved, all the stakeholders, were satisfied with the process and the program. And so throughout that, we were able to get feedback, which was very important. But a couple of challenges that we met along the way was we faced that the family physicians in the community were concerned about their patients following up with the ER versus with their own primary care providers. So we worked closely with the family physicians to ensure that the design of the program was such that patients would call their own family physicians to ensure they can be followed up within a couple of days. And then if they couldn't reach them or get that timely follow-up, then we would assign them to the clinic. So that was important and required some back and forth communication. And just ensuring that our family physicians did not feel like we were impinging on their area of work. The other challenge that we met was our ER physicians initially were not keen to come in for 2 hours of virtual care because they had to come into the building to provide this care to the hospital. They were not quite keen on coming in just for a 2-hour shift or on their days off. And so we looked at kind of how could we make it work so that it wasn't so onerous for physicians. And we usually have a 6-hour shift during our day where a physician comes in just for those 6 hours. And we tagged on this 2-hour virtual shift to an existing ER shift, which I think made it worthwhile for them to come in a couple hours earlier and see those patients. And it wasn't taking up a whole other day of their week. And with regards to virtual follow-ups, we designed the process to be as simple as possible for our physicians. We want it to be a smooth transition from in-person to virtual care. And we want it to be safe and not a big liability for physicians to take on this extra work. So we opted for phone follow-ups, which made it easier for both the patients and the ER physicians, because our patients are older in age in Chilliwack, and that we find that they're not very tech savvy or have access to technology. In order to ensure safety for patients, we also ensured that we had a very strict criteria for which patients would qualify for phone follow-up so that it was safe. And so we created a follow-up criteria that was revised multiple times, especially for patients that were getting imaging results virtually, because you don't want to be giving ectopic pregnancy diagnoses or appendicitis diagnoses by phone. So we had to make the criteria very rigid, and that way we're not seeing undifferentiated patients or providing results for things that were very serious virtually. And I think our physician group was happy with that. And then we kept communication open between all stakeholders and modified the process continuously, ensuring that it was patient-centered, but collaborative. And that's what made it sustainable, I think.
Oh, that's great. And so with the project as a whole, you mentioned you ran a pilot initially, but were you ultimately successful in it, in the whole project? And how did you measure success?
It's a great question. So I think we were overall successful with the project because we asked for provider feedback and patient feedback, more importantly. And based on that feedback, we decided, do we continue with the service or is it not helpful? And so based on that feedback, our patients about 88% of patients completed a survey, and 95% of them wanted to continue to get follow-up virtually. They were so grateful to be able to get follow-up from their own home where it's convenient, where they can, you know, take their kids to school and pick them up and not have to travel in snow, for example, to get an imaging result follow-up. And 75% of them found the experience satisfactory or very satisfactory, both the explanations they got and just the whole overall experience. With regards to our physician survey, it was also great feedback, with 80% of them being satisfied with or very satisfied with the care they were providing. And then they wanted to continue to provide that care because patients were so appreciative. How we measured it, so we measured quite a few things, but over the 2 months, we looked at the number of telehealth visits, the number of unattached patients being seen, the number of imaging results being given virtually versus having these patients come back and wait for hours for those results. And so we found that we did about 58, on average, 58 visits virtually per week, of which 8 to 20 were to unattached patients, which is very important because these patients would have otherwise very little access to a physician. And 26% of imaging results were then provided virtually as well. So we cut ER visits by a quarter for patients coming in through or having the virtual follow-ups. And so those were important results for us to see. But I think the most important was the patient's voice, which they found it useful and safe and convenient.
Well, those are great results, actually. That's great to hear. Out of interest, was there anything that particularly surprised you during the project, or maybe after the project? Was there anything that caught you out?
So I think what surprises me and still surprises me is how grateful patients are. And I'm not sure why, but I feel like patients virtually are so much more grateful to receive these phone calls, even when I see them in the ER. And so they have just been home for 24 hours usually after their visits or so, and then they have questions. Maybe they didn't have clear instructions, or they forgot some of the instructions. So it's an opportunity for them to have all these questions answered instead of sitting at home worrying that they are not doing the right things or they don't remember what was given to them or told to them. So I think they're just so appreciative to have that opportunity to answer those questions. And to be reassured again that they're on the right track, or that maybe they need to seek more help. And I think I was maybe expecting some more incidences of providing imaging results that should have been in person, or that patients would have some negative outcomes, because virtual care still has its downsides, since we're not re-examining the patients or seeing them. That whole, we had very few, if any, cases of anybody with missed diagnoses or anything like that. In fact, we were able to give kind of some cancer diagnoses virtually as well. And patients were appreciative because during COVID, they couldn't bring their families into the ER, a visitor. And so at least at home, if they knew a diagnosis could be coming, because we were clarifying or doing advanced imaging, then they can be with family members if you're giving them a negative diagnosis or the diagnosis of cancer or something more serious once in a while.
There's no doubt that your project was a success, but what do you think the key factors were that led to the success of the project overall?
So I think one key factor to success for this project was that we involved all of our stakeholders early on in the design of the project and allowed kind of us to come back and refine the project whenever it was necessary. And those open lines of communication with regular updates and getting feedback as we needed it from the community physicians to modify the project made it more successful and sustainable. And another key factor from a QI perspective is that we started off with very small PDSA cycles. These are plan, do, study, act cycles, and small tests of change to help us to modify the process, design the process, and especially the inclusion criteria for safe patients for virtual follow-up. And so we ironed out all the kinks, and it was more smooth sailing once we spread it to the rest of our physician group. And so we did this with small tests of change with every part of the process, from which patients we were going to choose for virtual follow-up down to how we're going to document these virtual visits so that they are in keeping with the Fraser Health requirements. And so I would say communication, small PDSA cycles, and keeping the process simple.
That's really interesting to hear. Thank you. And thank you for explaining the project so well. And it's clearly a high quality project, and one that deserves to be spread to maybe other ED departments that might be might have a similar idea, or might need to develop something to solve a problem in their own ED department. And that sort of brings us nicely over to the second part of our interview and talking about publishing. So I'm going to hand over to Deanna now, who's going to take over.
A huge part of quality improvement is sharing your work, and obviously publishing is a venue for that. That is still rather new for a lot of physicians. I think it's not fully utilized. So I want to get some insights, Raj, about that. So your role is the Provincial Physician Quality Improvement Champion for Publishing. So can you tell us a little bit about why that role was developed, and what does this role entail?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Diala is a great example of the reason this role was developed. It's for those physician leads who have gone through, as Sharon said earlier, the PQI program and learned this quality improvement methodology and how to apply it to healthcare and do great work like Diala's work is, in a way to showcase that. In fact, physicians were coming to us saying that they want to showcase their work after their quality improvement project was done, or after it had made some beneficial results. And so finding a way to support them was the reason this role was developed. Really, it meant tackling barriers that existed to showcasing work. We say publishing as sort of the publishing in a journal, like Diala's was published in an internationally recognized journal. But showcasing your work can come in many forms. And poster presentations, speaking engagements, there's forums and things like that. And so we want to try and give physician leads the opportunity to do that and help support them.
No, that's very important. And so just on the thread of that, why do you believe physicians should be publishing their quality improvement work?
Yeah, this is something I try and preach all the time. And I usually explain it by how I first came to believe that it to be important is that I went to the IHI National Forum several years ago, and there was a writing workshop happening there where one of the IHI fellows was talking about publishing the work. And they said this very kind of, I don't know, to me it seemed like a controversial statement at the time, but they said that your quality improvement work is incomplete until it is published or showcased in some way, shape, or form. And the more I have been involved with quality improvement, the more I actually believe that to be true. I really think publishing your work or showcasing it some way, it helps to spread ideas, helps to bring something of value to the work that the team puts into the project. And it also add something of value to the field of knowledge. So now Diala's work exists in this field where people from all over the world can build on that to either make improvements further, to adopt into their system. Whereas if Diala did not publish this work, then someone else out there is going to come into the same problem or maybe looking for a similar kind of solution and not know about it. So that's how I try and convince people.
Do you know, or have you observed any misconceptions or misunderstandings that you think physicians have regarding publishing?
You know, I think probably the main one would be that oftentimes physicians who go through quality improvement and learn about quality improvement may not realize or may not think that their work is suitable for publication or worth showcasing in some way, shape, or form. And I think that's false. I think your work should be showcased in some way, even if you don't have positive results, because we oftentimes learn from even our failures, and not even failures, but our efforts that maybe, you know, went without the results we're looking for. There's still beneficial information that can be obtained from that. So I think that's probably the main thing is trying to educate. Trying to educate regarding the importance of QI publishing.
And I'm wondering if you can expand on that education. So what specifically do you do in your role to help kind of break down those barriers or break down those misconceptions amongst physicians doing QI work?
Yeah, so this role was developed through Doctors of BC to try and identify those barriers. So physicians also like Diala, who are interested in publishing their work, what barriers do they come up across? And then how can we develop supports to overcome that, and so on and so forth? Because the publishing process can be this long, grueling ordeal that oftentimes takes many, many months. And along the way, there's many opportunities to just kind of throw in the towel and say, you know what, this is not, you know, this is not worth it, or you lose motivation and interest sometimes. So what are the barriers that exist for you to not get to the next step? And we try and identify all those. And there was almost like a 10-month long kind of environmental landscape review of sort of publishing supports and what's necessary. And then we tried to create some resources to be able to overcome those. And then we're still in the process of identifying more barriers that come up, and then try to tackle them accordingly.
No, that's great. Sounds like there's a lot of work going on. I wonder if you can just take us very briefly through the process that it requires to publish something sort of from start to finish in very basic terms.
Yeah, I mean, it's essentially going to start with doing a quality improvement project, and one that has sound methodology. So those who go through the quality, so physician leads who go through the quality improvement initiative or the PQI course, they learn the methodology of quality improvement and PDSA cycles and the model for improvement. And then once they've done a project, they oftentimes will find a way to measure change and show results, whether it be positive, negative, or neutral, and then show sustainability over time. There's a lot of evidence that goes into that, literature reviews, making sure that the project is sort of sound and built on sound knowledge. And then after that, once a project is sort of kind of on its way or getting some beneficial results, then you write up a manuscript. And there's production guidelines for quality improvement. It differs a little bit from research. We're so used to research production guidelines when going through medical school and our medical education, but quality improvement is a little bit different. There's a template for this called the Squire 2.0 guidelines. So develop a manuscript, have it reviewed by a peer mentor or a peer reviewer before submitting it to a journal or to a forum for a speaking engagement, whatever your formal publication is going to be or showcasing is going to be. Oftentimes, in this case, we talk about it being submitting to a journal. And then once the reviewers look at it, they will either give you an answer. They'll say they either reject your work, they'll approve it, or they'll say approval with some revisions that need to be done, or ask you to make some revisions. Then you make revisions, submit again, and then see if it gets approved. And this can take months, as DL will probably speak from experience, that it does take quite a bit of time.
And so, yes, turning back to you, DL, you've gone on to successfully publish your QI project. What was the process like for you?
The process was actually overall easier than I thought. I have only an NF1 to fall back on, so with the BMJ Open Quality Journal, and I felt like they had a great, easy platform to use. It was very clear communication with back and forth with the editors and administration. And I also felt like I had a great team I was working with, which made it actually quite enjoyable to go through the manuscript writing process. And it felt very rewarding to go through from early planning of the project to all the way to completion and publication. So that was actually quite rewarding to be able to follow through the QI project from beginning to end. I also had great regional support from Raj, and the provincial funding for publication was also very helpful. I found the Squire guidelines to be quite easy to follow and actually simplified the manuscript writing process. So an onerous task was made more simple through that. And I had an amazing support team with the Fraser Health Physician Quality Improvement Group as well. They gave me great data support. And I want to thank specifically Janice Eng, who did a lot of my graphing and data work. And I think if you have a great person on your team who can help with data for physicians, that makes a huge difference, or whoever's doing QI work. So I think the process was made simpler because of my team and the supports regionally that we have and provincially.
Well, that's great. And both of you seem to make it sound so easy. It's amazing that not everyone has caught on to this. But Diala, what advice would you give to any physician who might be considering publishing their QI work, maybe after hearing this podcast, for example?
So honestly, the publication process for QI is a lot less onerous than I thought it was going to be. The hardest part was building the courage and confidence to start writing. So once you have a good QI project with good results, I would just encourage you to just start writing, start planning and writing, because it will come as you go. And it's a lot easier than publishing in research. So I always found research more daunting and rigorous, but it's a lot easier. And if you use the Squire guidelines and read through the journal's requirements and follow that, it guides you quite well to how to go about the process. And definitely use your local, regional, and provincial QI publishing leaders for help, for assistance, for funding, for data support, because there's a lot of resources that you may not know that exist that can also make it easier on you. And another thing is to involve all of your team in the writing process. So it's not just one person writing for 10 hours, but you can actually spread it out so that it's not all on one member of the team to do all the writing. And then it would actually be a lot less time commitment and more enjoyable, because you can do it as a team and enjoy the process. And whether or not my manuscript was accepted, I felt like it was a great learning experience. Just the whole process with publication and going through the steps was a great learning experience. I would encourage you just get started if you have a good project that you're working on.
Great. Well, thank you. Well, it's been great. You've really gone a long way, both of you, to demystifying the whole issue of publishing. And it's been great hearing about your project as well. And we're nearing the end of the interview, but we're not quite there yet, because I still have two more questions for each of you. And it's the same question that we ask all our guests that come on the show. And I'm going to start with you, Raj, if that's okay. But what do you like about living and working in BC? And do you have a favorite place or activity you like to do to relax and put away work from the back of your mind?
Wow, there's so much to choose from, actually. I divide it up into two, sort of summer and winter, just because I find that my favorite place in the winter is different than the summer. Summertime, I live in Vancouver, so I love hiking, and there's this Grouse Mountain. For those who don't know where Grouse Mountain is, it's a short track just outside of the city, out of downtown, and they have this hike there called the Grouse Grind, which is fantastic. It's a great exercise, and once you get to the top, the views are very rewarding, as is the food and kind of snacks and stuff they have up there. So summertime is Grouse Grind, beautiful, beautiful kind of hike. And in the winter, I like to snowboard, actually. Get a chance to, because the work schedule a lot here locally, but I actually like coming up to the interior. So I think my favorite place in the winter is one of the mountains around Kelowna. Most recently was Big White. Enjoy going to Big White for a family ski trip and enjoy that. So snowboarding up there.
That's great. So snowboarding soon, I dare say. Well, have you been out already?
Yeah. Not yet. Hopefully soon, though.
Excellent. And what about you, Diala? What sort of things do you like to do, and where do you like to go?
I love beautiful BC's outdoors. So I think we all live in BC for that. There's so many beautiful, stunning landscapes, the various mountain ranges and lakes. So like Raj, I love hiking. So maybe we'll have to have you over to the valley one day to enjoy our beautiful hikes out here. So my favorite hike out here is up to Sham Mountain. And so it's about a 4-hour hike for me. I'm not very fast, but it's a beautiful view for up the whole valley from the top. I also actually enjoy road tripping around BC quite a bit. So my husband and my daughter and I, we road trip and we go hunting for hot springs. And so we love both the off-the-grid hot springs as well as some of the commercialized ones. But that's kind of, you hike the day and then you enjoy the hot springs in the evening. It's awesome.
Well, those are great answers. Thank you. Yes. And we know that we have a number of listeners who are from outside BC and outside Canada. And I'm hoping that we can attract some of them to come and visit beautiful British Columbia at some point through this podcast. Well, thank you so much to both of you, Diala and Raj, for joining us today. It's been really great having you on the show and hearing about your work. As a token of our appreciation, we will be sending you, of course, each one of you, one of our exclusive and highly coveted Quality Cast North coffee mugs. But here comes the closing music. which means we're at the end of the interview. If you, the listener, want to find out more about today's episode, please look up the show notes on our website, where you can also find links to our other episodes. Until next time, I'm Cher Chewy.
And I'm Deanna Danskin.
And you've been listening to Quality Cast North. Today's episode was hosted and co-produced by Dr. Cher Chewy and Deanna Danskin, with technical support from Matt Walker. Original music by Daniel Chewy, and artistic support by Reggie Goodine. Quality Cast North is recorded on the traditional territory of the Clayclaytonay First Nation. If you enjoyed today's interview, check out our other episodes available on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you find your podcasts.